Penguin Random House Audio presents Samsung Rising, the inside story of the South Korean giant that set out to beat Apple and conquer tech, by Jeffrey Kane. Read for you by Michael Braun. Note on research, translations, and Korean names. I interviewed more than 400 current and former Samsung employees, executives, politicians, business people, board members, journalists, activists, and analysts, as well as a member of Samsung's founding Lee family. Samsung did not cooperate with this book. Most of my interviews were through unofficial channels. Samsung, however, cooperated with my earlier magazine reporting for Time and Fast Company. Those official interviews are included. The interviews took place in South Korea, Japan, China, New York, New Jersey, Texas, and California. Many interviewees did not want to be named or go on the record. I have respected their wishes. Many graciously offered to help me, knowing their careers were at great risk and with little benefit to themselves. Interviews were conducted in Korean, Japanese, and English, depending on the needs of the interviewee. Many Korean figures of speech don't translate fluidly into English. I have double-checked these statements with the subjects to ensure that the original intent was not lost, with the help of my researcher, Max Son Kim, talented young Guardian stringer and native Korean speaker. This book follows no single convention for Korean names. It follows the personal preferences of the people I interviewed and wrote about. Most Koreans prefer the standard usage, family name first, given name second. On second mention, some write their given names as initials. Lee Byung-chul, for instance, becomes B.C. Lee. Sometimes Koreans prefer to hyphenate their given names, Lee Gun-hee. Sometimes they leave out the hyphen, Park Chul-won. The revised romanization system is used throughout. Researching this book, I used a mixture of investigative journalism and ethnography methods, drawing on my academic background in anthropology. For archival research, I consulted the collections at my graduate school alma mater, the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, as well as the Presidential Archives and National Assembly Library of Korea. Chapter 1. Galaxy Death Star. "Leave your bags, get off the plane immediately," shouted the flight attendant. Brian Green felt he'd entered a nightmare. The morning of October 5th, 2016, Green had taken his seat on Southwest Flight 994 at Kentucky's Louisville International Airport, where he was preparing for a business trip in Baltimore. 10 minutes before takeoff, during the safety demonstration, he powered down his new Samsung Galaxy phone and put it in his pocket. "I heard some popping that sounded like a Ziploc popping open," Brian later told a television crew in his southern accent, "and looked around to see what that was. There was smoke just billowing, pouring out of my pocket." He yanked his smartphone from his pants pocket and threw it on the carpeted floor. "I didn't want it to explode in my hand," he said. Angry, thick, green-gray smoke was billowing out of it. The smoke spread several rows in front of him and behind him before dissipating throughout the rest of the cabin. The Southwest Airlines crew decided it was time to get everyone out. By 9:20 a.m., the flight attendants had evacuated all 75 passengers and crew members. Emergency crews arrived to retrieve the smoldering device and to check the passengers for injuries. Fortunately, no one lost a finger or a hand over it, as Green put it. He had tossed the phone away just in time. The smoking piece of metal, plastic, and circuitry was so hot that it had burned right through the carpet. When airline mechanics pulled the layer of carpet away to reveal the subfloor underneath, it was seared and blackened. Investigators from the arson unit at the Louisville Fire Department showed up on the tarmac, seized the device, and questioned Green. But Green, they quickly realized, had done nothing wrong. The problem lay in the phone that he had bought, loved, and admired. The Galaxy Note 7 had been a source of trouble for 2 months in South Korea, in the United States, and around the world. But everyone had assumed the problem had been resolved. Since late August, Samsung had documented 92 instances of its new, much-heralded Galaxy Note 7 device overheating in the hands and homes and cars of its customers. A number of them caught fire thanks to what Samsung claimed were faulty batteries. After 3 weeks of stumbling and stammering around the faulty device, Samsung had begun to recall the Galaxy Note 7s in the United States. As the company had advised, Brian Greene had exchanged his new Note 7 at the AT&T store 2 weeks before his flight. Greene had studied the replacement phone and its packaging carefully. All indications on Samsung's packaging were that the device was safe to use. The box was marked with a black square, indicating a replacement device rather than an original Note 7. When he punched the new phone's IMEI, a unique 15-digit number on every device, into Samsung's recall eligibility website, he got this recorded response. "Great news. Your device is not in the list of affected devices." After the evacuation, Brian called Samsung's customer service line. "I did everything I was supposed to do," he explained to the Samsung rep. "This was a recalled phone." The rep patched his message into a ticketing system. Greene wondered when he'd hear back from Samsung. The company was slow to treat the incident as a public safety issue. Instead, when journalists followed up on the incident, the company sounded skeptical that the phone was at fault. "Until we are able to retrieve the device, we cannot confirm that this incident involves the new Note 7," company representatives wrote to journalists repeatedly. Investigators from the Consumer Product Safety Commission, CPSC, the federal agency whose job it is to test faulty and dangerous products, saw things differently. They initiated decisive and unusually strong legal measures. Citing exigent circumstances, CPSC investigators obtained a court subpoena and seized Greene's phone from the Louisville Fire Department the day after the fire. The team drove it to a laboratory in Bethesda, Maryland, where they got to work on an urgent succession of tests. The gravity of the situation was becoming clearer. It's one thing for a company to issue a recall. It's another for that same company to reissue replacement products labeled safe that continue to pose a severe danger to the public. While Samsung remained unmoved by the public inquiry, 13-year-old Abby Zuiz was picking up her siblings 2 days later at North Trail Elementary School in Farmington, Minnesota. Playing with her replacement Galaxy Note 7, she suddenly felt a strange burning sensation on her hand. Like pins and needles, she recalled, except a lot more intense. Her immediate reflex was to throw the phone on the floor, thankfully with no more than a burn mark on her thumb. The school principal raced forward and kicked the smoldering device out of the building. "I'm glad it was in my hand and not my pocket," Zuiz told the media later. "We thought we were safe with the new phone," her father said. Michael Claring and his wife woke up at 4 a.m. in his Kentucky home to a hissing noise. "The whole room just covered in smoke. Smells awful," Claring told a local radio station. "I look over, and my phone is on fire." Later that day, Claring started vomiting black fluid. He checked into the emergency room, where he was diagnosed with acute bronchitis. Doctors determined that he suffered from smoke inhalation. A Samsung representative contacted Claring and asked him to return the Note 7. Claring refused. Then he received a text message sent accidentally to him by a Samsung employee. "I can try and slow him down if we think it will matter," the text read. "Or we just let him do what he keeps threatening to do and see if he does it." Claring was aghast. What the heck was going on? The most disturbing part of this is that Claring's phone caught fire on Tuesday, one day before the Southwest flight, and Samsung knew about it and didn't say anything, wrote The Verge's Jordan Golson. Warned Gizmodo's Rhett Jones. The evidence suggests that Samsung now appears to be suppressing the information that replacements are dangerous. The reports continued to stream in with no decisive statement or action.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?